From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. It's been 50 years since the invention of the goalie mask. Ahead on Only a Game, how a little piece of molded fiberglass changed the game of hockey. Also, the 0-12 New Jersey Nets look to Russia for help, and Spartak Moscow and its quietly dissident fans take on a squad supported by the Soviet Union's secret police. Also ahead, basketball grannies share the court with the young whippersnappers.
They've been coached all their lives, and they've got moves and good stuff. We shoot a lot of hook shots because that was the shot of the 50s.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The NBA's New Jersey Nets are on a 12-game losing streak. Coincidentally, they've built that streak during the first 12 games of their season. Meanwhile, a lawsuit filed Thursday is seeking to block the team's plans for a new arena in Brooklyn. Joining me now to discuss what else can go wrong with the Nets is Dave D'Alessandro of the Newark Star-Ledger. Dave, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Good to be here.
Let's start on the court. The Nets are the only team in the NBA without a victory thus far. What are the main problems on the court?
Well, your typical 0-12 team is a banana republic in turmoil, but this is a little different, Bill. I think they can primarily point to the number of injuries they've had. I mean, they literally have lost 7 of their top 10 players. They have more than 60 manpower games lost to injury, and we're talking about essential pieces, namely Devin Harris, their only all-star, and a number of others. When you're missing 7 of your top 10, you generally tend to drag a little bit, and it's not like your typical bad team that is going to start pointing fingers and having internal problems. These guys still do play hard every night, and as absurd as that sounds with the 0-12 group, I think eventually they're going to probably get their number of wins, maybe as early as tonight when they play the Knicks.
New Jersey is a team in transition in more ways than one. In September, Russian billionaire Mikhail Prokhorov reached a tentative $200 million agreement to become the Nets' principal owner. What has to happen before that deal can go through?
Well, the NBA says it's just about completing its vetting process. Some people inside the organization say it might take until January before he actually goes to a vote before the NBA Board of Governors. But in the past, David Stern, the commissioner of the league, generally gets whatever he wants out of the Board of Governors, so that isn't considered a major obstacle. And the one question that is still lingering out there is whether Prokhorov will still go through with the deal if the Brooklyn project falls apart. Very recently, there have been reports that he's now willing to stick it out and give the team a try and keep the team in New Jersey, perhaps in Newark, obviously, if there is no Atlantic Yards project, which just tells you that he really wants to stay in the game and develop Russian basketball as a sort of a sidelight. But that remains to be seen. We haven't heard from Prokhorov directly yet.
What's your best guess on this? Do the Nets get to go to Brooklyn? Do they stay in New Jersey? Do they move to New York? What happens eventually?
There's just no sense of guessing, Bill. Right now we do have the legal obstacles related to the eminent domain issues. And then, of course, the team still has to sell an awful lot of bonds, about $700 million worth, before December 31st in order to maintain their tax-exempt status. So an awful lot has to happen very quickly. The Court of Appeals has to give a favorable ruling very soon. It could be as early as next week. But then the Nets basically want to get the bulldozers in the ground by the second week of December in order to start issuing bonds. And that's it's getting near the 11th hour, and and they're getting very nervous about it.
If the Nets did end up moving to Brooklyn, do you suppose they would hold on to whatever fans they have in New Jersey?
To be honest with you, I don't see it. I think just a move to Newark would bring an entirely different fan base. I think it's almost different worlds. We here in the metropolitan area generally live by the two bridge rule. If you have to cross two bridges, you don't go somewhere. And it's I tend to think that even though they tell us they're going to hold on to some of their season ticket holders, frankly, as a lifelong New Jerseyan, I wouldn't go to Brooklyn if I had to. But and again, if they go to Newark, that's a totally different animal. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the perfect life raft for either the temporary timetable or even long term, because that's a venue. The Prudential building is a state of the sport facility, and it's a venue that derives 80% of its audience from mass transportation. The current one doesn't get any. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about an entirely different market with an entirely different audience.
Over the past several seasons, the Nets have let a number of big-name players go. Kenyon Martin, Jason Kidd, most recently Vince Carter. How much have those moves hurt fan interest in the team?
I think quite a bit. It's dwindled slowly into an abyss over the last 4 years. There have been some very good moments when Vince Carter was healthy along with Richard Jefferson and Jason Kidd, but you know, management decided that team has gone as far as it can, and so you tend to change direction and go for a team that is younger, and then it can build for something a lot bigger, which, of course, is a championship. So I think this is going to build, and if they don't beat the Knicks tonight, we're looking at a possible record, because they've lost 12 now, and the record at the start of the season for consecutive losses is 17, shared by the Miami Heat team from 20 years ago, and I want to say the Clippers from the lockout season.
Dave D'Alessandro covers the Nets for the Newark Star-Ledger. Dave, thanks very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
Imagine a hard black hockey puck hurtling toward you. Now imagine that puck hitting you right in the face. That's exactly what happened to goalies for decades before one player decided 50 years ago this month that it was time for a change. Only a game's Doug Tribou reports.
Montreal Canadiens goaltender Jacques Plante should have been happy. It was the fall of 1959. His team was beginning its quest for a fifth straight Stanley Cup, and Plante was coming off his fourth season as an NHL All-Star. But Plante was fed up with being hit in the face with hockey pucks. Fred Addis is a member of the Society for International Hockey Research.
He had fractured each of his cheekbones once and had his nose broken twice and had totaled some 150 stitches before the 1959-60 season opened.
On November 1st, Plante and the Canadiens were in New York. A Rangers shot hit Plante in the nose and mouth, leaving cuts that required stitches. When he returned to the game, his face was hidden behind a form-fitting fiberglass mask. The future Hall of Famer would wear a mask for the rest of his career. According to Addis, Canadian goalies had been experimenting with masks long before Plante, including a female goaltender in Ontario who tried a fencing mask in 1926. The story of Plante's innovative fiberglass mask begins at Hamilton College in Clinton, New York. Don Spencer played goalie for the Hamilton hockey team in the late 1950s. Hamilton's athletic trainer and track coach, Gene Long, had been developing fiberglass heel cups for his high and long jumpers. Spencer says he asked Long for help after an injury in the fall of 1958.
I had a slap shot go off my ankle bone and just wouldn't heal up, and he made a fiberglass plate. After that, he obviously got thinking about his applicability as far as being a potential technique for developing a face mask.
In early 1959, Spencer and Gene Long began talking about making a fiberglass mask. Long says the original process began with plaster of Paris, and it was especially unpleasant for claustrophobic goalies.
For it meant that you covered up the whole face except for, you know, possibly a straw in the mouth to breathe or leaving the mouth ajar while you covered this whole face with essentially a cast.
By the time Long had finished Spencer's mask, Hamilton's season was over. But around that time, Spencer heard about another goalie in the market for some facial protection.
In mid-April, there was an article in the newspaper talking about the fact that Jacques Plante, who had also been chewed up pretty badly that season, so that he was beginning to look for a face mask. And so I wrote Jacques Plante about that process and hoped for a response.
Spencer never heard back, but researcher Fred Addis believes Spencer's letter prompted Plante to abandon the problematic plexiglass shields many goalies had begun using in practice. Over the years, some reports have erroneously credited Plante with creating the fiberglass mask, which was actually made by a fiberglass salesman named Bill Birchmore. Birchmore and Plante are deceased, and it's not clear how they met. Addis says they later formed a mask-making business, and Birchmore helped pioneer other styles, including the pretzel mask, which featured bars. Jerry Cheevers wore a white fiberglass mask during a career spent mostly with the Boston Bruins between 1965 and 1980. The Hall of Famer played on two Stanley Cup championship teams, but his biggest contribution to the game might be his mask. Cheevers came to practice one day thinking about how to get out of practice and how to decorate his shield. A relatively soft shot off the fiberglass solved both problems. Cheevers faked an injury and asked a trainer to come up with something to prove he'd been hurt.
So he takes his magic mark and paints a huge stitch, like a 12-inch scar in the mask. So we got it. I said, see, I was very seriously hurt, and we got a little chuckle out of it. And I said, this is a good idea. I finally answered the question of how I'm going to decorate my mask.
Cheevers continued adding stitches whenever a puck hit his mask, sometimes even putting them on between periods. And soon it was covered. The image became so iconic that Cheevers now has a business selling signed mounted replicas. Today's masks bear no resemblance to Plante's original. The current models are more like helmets and often feature elaborate artwork on the entire shell. Dominic Malerba owns Pro's Choice Goalie Masks in Middleton, Massachusetts, and has been making customized masks for pros and amateurs for 20 years. His NHL clients have included Mike Smith, Andy Moog, Mike Richter, and Olaf Kolzig. The slapshots of today's top defensemen, like Boston's Zdeno Chara, routinely break 100 miles an hour. Malerba says that's why goalies need better technology.
Not too long ago, but maybe a couple weeks ago when the Bruins were playing Edmonton, Chara went down the middle with a slap shot and hit Habby Boulin, one of my guys, straight in the face, and he didn't even flinch.
Malerba's NHL masks cost approximately $2,200 apiece. After Gene Long made his first mask in 1959, word spread and his hobby turned into a small side business. Long says it took him 3 5-hour days to make each one, and it wasn't all that profitable.
Quite frankly, it was my Christmas money for my three growing girls. I started out selling these masks at $25 each, mostly for high school and college goalies. I don't think that they ever got as expensive as $50. So it was Christmas money and fun.
But when Jacques Plante first donned Bill Birchmore's mask during an NHL game, it wasn't a fun transition. Many coaches, players, and team executives, even within the Canadiens organization, criticized Plante and feared that masks would create distance in the relationship between fans and their favorite players. But hockey researcher Fred Addis says while some goalies took years to come around, Plante's stature in the game helped masks gain acceptance.
He was the best goalie by far in the National Hockey League, and when the best goalie in the league puts on something as innovative as a face mask, people are going to follow suit. In one season, they were unacceptable and only worn by cowards. In the following season, there were hockey organizations that were mandating their players to wear them.
For Only a Game, I'm Doug Trabu.
Took off that mask. Don't think you should show your face around here. So if you got through, you know it's not the end of the world. Take off that mask. It's okay. There's friends around here.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Last week, on the occasion of the 5th annual Guinness World Records Day, records fell in clusters. A new fastest time for eating a bowl of pasta was established in, where else, Italy. And in Norway, dedicated bakers built the world's largest gingerbread man, which weighed 1,435 pounds. In Finland, 76 people squeezed into a single sauna, which established the mark for that particular folly. And in London, Manjit Singh pulled a double-decker bus 21.2 meters with his hair, an achievement rendered doubly sweet because just 2 years ago, Mr. Singh had failed to break the record for pulling that bus with his ears.
Look at all those ears.
Look at all those boobs.
An office full of morons.
A factory full of fools.
Is it any wonder
that I'm singing the blues?
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Really, Granny, it's okay to cross the midcourt line. But first, the women's college basketball season has begun with games featuring scores like 107-48, 124-34, and 100-55. Michelle Smith, who writes about women's hoops for AOL Fanhouse and edits LeftCoastHoops.com, joins me now. Michelle, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
I'm going to invite you to begin by talking about the team closest to your West Coast heart, which is Stanford, ranked number 2 in the nation. They already have one Ogwumike on the roster. Sophomore Nneka was recently named Pac-10 Player of the Week. And next, Coach Tara Vanderveer will have little sister Ogwumike as well, although she's not that little.
No, she's not. Chinne Ogwumike is the number one recruit in the country, and she signed with Stanford, which was not that big of a surprise. She was had narrowed her choices to Stanford and Connecticut, which, you know, is the number one, number two teams in the country. But she's going to join her sister at Stanford, and I'm sure Tara Vanderveer is pretty happy about that. She's big. She's a different player than her sister. Nneka is kind of very much an in-the-paint player. Chinne is more of a three, kind of a wing, likes to drive and slash. And, you know, Nneka's more of a rebounder and a scorer inside. But they're going to make a nice tandem for Stanford for a few years.
So Stanford will be very good when those two are playing together. But Stanford is very good right now. They hammered Old Dominion and Rutgers, two generally well-regarded teams. Are they likely to be challenged before they play Tennessee a month from now?
I don't know, challenged. They've got a challenging schedule. They are... this week, aside a little bit, they played Pepperdine on Thursday. They play UC Davis on Sunday. And then the degree of difficulty ramps up. They've got Utah. They've got Gonzaga, who's kind of around the edge of the rankings. They'll play DePaul. Then they play Duke and then Tennessee. And then on the 23rd of December, they go to Hartford and play Connecticut. So they've set themselves up with kind of a tough schedule, and they're looking to see how they measure up.
Tennessee is ranked 5th in the ESPN USA Today poll and 6th in the AP poll. Did they look stronger than that to you as they beat Baylor on Sunday and Texas Tech on Tuesday?
They look very strong. They look much improved. I think they're fresh. Last year's freshmen are sophomores, and that makes all the difference. I think they look like a Final Four team, and that's hard to say in November, obviously, but they seem to have all of the pieces. There are a couple of key spots, I think, where they're not incredibly deep inside in particular. I think an injury on the inside would be a problem for them. But they're hoping to get Vicky Baugh back, who's had a couple of knee injuries over the last couple of years. But if they stay healthy, they are a very good team.
Speaking of rankings, there's a real discrepancy in them with regard to LSU. The AP poll has them at number 7. The ESPN USA Today poll has LSU at 17. Which one's wrong?
Well, I'm an AP voter, so let's see.
Well, that's easy then.
I think LSU, I think this is an interesting year for the voters because it seems like there are two or three teams who are pretty heads and above this year, and then a lot of other teams that we're not quite sure about. There are a lot of established programs who are starting over with a lot of young players, and I think LSU is one of those that, you know, was an elite team and is maybe starting over again, and it's kind of hard to judge where they sit compared to, say, Duke and North Carolina or Oklahoma or Texas or some of these programs that are probably belong, you know, in that 5 to 15 range, and you're not sure where they're going to shake out yet.
Michelle, we would not normally be talking about Delaware because they are not traditionally a powerhouse. However, this year's Delaware squad features the woman who was the top high school player in the country two seasons back. After deciding last year that she did not want to attend the University of Connecticut after all, Elena Deladon, back home, has rediscovered her love for basketball. So, does Delaware go undefeated?
Well, sure. You know, Elena Deladon's a great player, but she's one player, and I'm not sure what they have around her. In a way, it's a cautionary tale, and it's also a nice story. I mean, you know, there's, you know, the kid that was highly recruited that put everything into basketball and then got to Connecticut. And, you know, and the bottom line for her, as she said, is that she wanted to be close to home. She has a special needs sibling at home that she didn't want to leave. She wanted to be close to her family. And, you know, and now she's getting to play and kind of figuring out that it wasn't basketball that was the problem, really. It was being away from home that was the problem. And, you know, for all of us parents of teenagers and things, that's kind of a nice sentiment. But I think Delaware people are going to pay a lot more attention to that team this year.
She played in front of 900 fans the other night in her first game. That's what, about a tenth or maybe less of what would have seen her in Connecticut?
Yes, but maybe 100% more of what would have seen Delaware play in their season opener on a regular night. I think it's relative. I mean, I think that crowd's going to build. It depends, I think, on, you know, their win-loss record and what kind of season they have, but people are going to want to see her play.
I have put off talking about the Connecticut team, the defending champion, for as long as I could, but the Huskies still have Maya Moore, perhaps the best player in the country. They're still coached by Gino Auriemma. Is there any reason to doubt that UConn will repeat as champions?
Probably not. They're very good, and there's no reason to think that they aren't going to probably go back and end up with the trophy over their head at the end of the year. But there are a couple of teams who might have something to say about it. I think Stanford is one because of their size and their depth, and they have everybody back. And, you know, I think Tennessee could figure in, and then you can maybe get Pat and Gino in that final and get the game that everybody wants to see, but, you know, you can't get the two of them in the same room anymore.
Year after year, the confrontation that everybody wants to see.
You know, you can't help it. I think it's so much in so much professional sports, there's been so much parity that's kind of watered down those dynasties. And, you know, sports thrives on those teams that you always know you can look to. And women's basketball, I think, absolutely lives for Connecticut and Tennessee matchups.
Michelle Smith is the women's basketball writer for AOL Fanhouse and the editor of LeftCoastHoops.com. Michelle, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
For parents of basketball-playing teens, the winter months mean eating dinner on the way to weeknight practices, washing uniforms, and long drives to away games. It doesn't leave a lot of time for visits to Grandma's house. But for the daughters of one Massachusetts town, basketball season brings the opportunity to play a friendly tournament with Grandma on the adjacent court. Only a Game's Karen Given has the story.
It's another 2 weeks before girls' basketball tryouts at Winchester High School. But on this Saturday morning, all eight half courts in the gym are full. To the right, a team of high schoolers in red t-shirts, hand-decorated with fabric paint and glitter, play another high school team in mismatched gray. To the left, the Nova Super 60s from Virginia show off their flashy, professionally embroidered blue and reds against the equally spiffy-looking Connecticut Sirens in black and white. In all, 12 seniors teams have come from five different states to compete in the Rock the Ages intergenerational three-on-three tournament. Over the next few hours, they'll raise money for the girls' basketball program at Winchester High and show the younger generation how it's done.
That was and is my vision.
Tina Quick came up with this idea last year when, as the mother of a varsity captain, she was in charge of helping the team raise money.
Quite frankly, I got tired of the fundraisers being something that all the parents just showed up at and spent money on all night long.
Tina plays for the Massachusetts Miracles, a traveling team for women 50 and older. Since graduating high school in the days before Title IX, Tina's been creating her own opportunities to play basketball. She sees this tournament not only as a way for the high school team to raise some cash, but also as a way for the girls to learn a little about the history of women's basketball.
These are the pioneers of the sport, and the young kids, it's just always been here for them, and they never had to think what these women went through for the privilege of playing on the hard court.
Box, box!
On court five, the Golden Cagers are decked out head to toe in orange Syracuse basketball gear, a nod to their hometown, Syracuse, New York. Sue Heiss says now in her 50s, she's finally living her college dream. But the game is changing as Title IXers age up into the senior ranks.
You can almost see the break when you watch the over 50 team play. They have a different mentality on the court and a different ability because they had all that coaching. And you can tell Brenda's coaching on the floor, too, because she played in college.
Brenda Engbretson played college ball in Canada. Sue calls her the elder statesperson of the Golden Cagers. And Brenda responds to that distinction by flipping her teammates the bird. Brenda is an exercise physiologist, and when she gives lectures to medical students on the importance of exercise, she always starts by showing a slide of her basketball team. She says basketball isn't for everyone, but everyone should find a lifelong sport.
You know, I feel just as motivated and competitive, and I can reveal my age, I'm 60, now, as at least I recall that I was in college, maybe even more so.
Nobody shoot, Paula!
The Connecticut High Fives aren't very impressed with a team whose oldest member is 60. Not a single member of the High Fives is younger than 67. And Mary Berlin, the oldest player at this tournament, turns 71 next month. The High Fives often face younger opponents, but Mary says playing alongside junior high and high schoolers is an experience unique to this tournament.
That's why they call it Rock the Ages, which I don't like because it sounds too much like Rock of Ages, which is, in my book, a funeral song. I don't want it to get that close.
Mary might not like the name of this tournament, but she loves watching younger players on the court.
They've been coached all their lives, and they've got moves and good stuff. We shoot a lot of hook shots because that was the shot of the 50s. That's one of the things I like best about it. We're learning new things and getting your body to do things that it didn't do before, not just the old stuff.
And court number 9, and the Pink Dinosaurs and the Purple Monkeys.
Even the team names reflect the generations. While the 6th graders are prone to whimsy, the senior teams use names like Moxie and Quicksilver. Marissa McDonald and her team won the high school age bracket, and she stayed behind to watch the senior women play.
I think it's awesome, honestly. Power to you. They're all like them, like knee braces and everything, but they're still out there playing, and they're just loving life. It's good times.
At the first Rock the Ages tournament, there wasn't a whole lot of interaction between the younger and older players. So as the senior women rest between games, freshman Catherine Pitts and Lizzie Savage wander the gym, offering each of them a red carnation. For the flower, the girls get a little conversation. They chit-chat about the upcoming high school tryouts. They hear stories about traveling to senior tournaments and the National Seniors Games. But for Catherine and Lizzie, they learn the most from watching the older women play.
Yeah, they're good.
Are you surprised?
Yeah, when they're setting screens, they really hit people.
You're really physical.
The senior women don't reach gingerly for the ball. They dive after it. Their fouls are deliberate and hard. When an opponent tries to snatch the ball away, they hang on for dear life. Nancy Richardson and Joe Lannon of the Maine Flashes say anyone who expects the senior women to play a polite, dainty game are in for a shock.
The referees kind of come expecting that, too.
Yeah, they do.
They get surprised.
Yeah.
Certainly when we played in high school, it wasn't as physical. And so when we started playing as 50-year-olds, I think that was the part of the game we kind of had to learn. It was the first time somebody hits you, it's sort of like, hey, this is a non-contact sport. What are you doing? Then you kind of get used to it.
Shoot!
Yay! Way to go! Woo!
After winning their first game in double overtime and their second game against younger and taller opponents, the Connecticut High Fives are behind by 2 as the final minutes wind down on their third and final game. They've been playing together for 10 years, practicing every week, traveling for tournaments, and Phyllis Serafin says only her teammates know how tough it is.
I don't think anyone understands what it takes at 65 and 70 years old to play the game of basketball. So tomorrow we'll probably all get up with a few aches and pains, but we don't stop. We just keep going. That's what you have to do in the aging process is keep moving.
The buzzer sounds on another narrow High Fives victory, and Phyllis and her teammates gather for smiles and hugs in the middle of the court. Tomorrow, there will be aches and pains, but the High Fives will know that they left this tournament undefeated.
Does that make it a little bit easier to get up tomorrow morning?
Absolutely much easier. That was fun.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
You're listening to Only a Game. Last week's program featured a story by Chad Bouchard about bull racing in Indonesia. Heather O'Leary, who hears Only a Game on WAMC in Albany, was among those who found the story inappropriate. "I'm difficult to offend," she wrote, "but you've done it. As a veterinarian and as a human being, I am ashamed for you and the reporter who submitted the piece." A listener named Jane appended a note to the story on our website. She wrote, "Appalling, appalling, appalling. This segment was an endorsement of the most heinous animal cruelty, and cynical exploitation of children for the entertainment of sadists. I was completely horrified at the story. Lots of other listeners felt the story was ill-chosen, though some appreciated it. A listener named Kristen wrote, "I am grateful as ever for NPR bringing such well-crafted stories to us from around the world. Only narrow-minded individuals would seek to ban a story depicting real life in a place where few travel and even fewer will understand." In response to some of the objections to his story, reporter Chad Bouchard wrote, "While working on this story, I struggled with mixed feelings about animal mistreatment in the sport. I don't think the bull's pain should be discarded or justified. I also don't think the solution is to shut the radio off or recommend the journalists stop talking about them." Gail Lipschultz is among the listeners who support that position. Having heard Chad Bouchard's story, she wrote, "Only a game is not to be missed. Where else could I hear a story about an Indonesian bull sled race? The stories are literate and fabulous." Bob Boat, who hears the program on WFYI in Indianapolis, emailed to say, "I listened twice to the interview with Chad Ochocinco in an effort to understand why I dislike him and his ilk. The only recommendation I have for Chad and other shameless self-promoters is shut up and play the game. I enjoy the show. Keep up the great work." Sean Hallenbeck, who hears the program on WAER in Syracuse, emailed to say he appreciates senior producer Gary Wallach's music choices. "You used Red Barchetta from the band Rush when you did a story on high-powered electric cars. I was tickled by your choice of such an obscure song from an underrated band. Keep up the great work on my favorite NPR show." Sean, Mr. Wallach has asked me to thank you for the compliment, though he's quite sure you heard Red Barchetta on another show. Convey your sentiments through our website, onlyagame.org, or write us at Only A Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Though the most recent edition of the World Rock, Paper, Scissors Championship was held in Toronto, Canadians were shut out of the final, which, for the first time in tournament history, pitted two U.S. contestants against each other. Tim Conrad emerged victorious, and no wonder, he was dressed as Captain America during the competition. Conrad was victorious over Tom Butkin with Paper Covering Rock, a triumph which concluded 5 hours of play. It would be tempting to dismiss the entire affair as silly, except that Tim Conrad took home $7,000 in prize money. Hold on to that paper. Hold on to that paper. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, rooting for a soccer team as a political act. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce, who's in Oxford, Mississippi, for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Well, I'm not in Oxford for a discussion of the week's news. We can do that anywhere. I'm in Oxford visiting folks. Anyway, hello to our new friends at WBFO HD3 in Buffalo, and you have the condolence of the entire Only a Game sports team on your football team, which we were not going to talk about very much.
Not today, anyway. On Wednesday, the Irish and the French engaged in a game of soccer in order to determine which team would get to go to South Africa for the World Cup finals this summer. France scored the goal that clinched their place in the tournament after Thierry Henry touched the ball with his hand at least once, maybe twice. So do you take Ireland's side in the dispute that has resulted?
Look, I'm not Mr. Soccer. You're Mr. Soccer. But anybody who saw this and doesn't think the Irish got cheated is blind or French. And my favorite part of this whole thing is Monsieur Henry himself, who's admitted that he did it and has essentially told the world, look, it's not my job to catch me. It's their job to catch me. And of course we should replay the game, but it's not my decision. They're supposed to decide to replay the game. I cheated. What are you going to do about it? Zut alors.
Well, the great thing about what Henri said is it gives me a chance to say, yes, I did do that thing.
I put it to you that you are a professional Thierry Henry interpreter.
All right, Mr. NASCAR. Tomorrow, Jimmy Johnson will quite likely earn his fourth straight championship, which would set a record. Johnson seemingly had matters wrapped up weeks ago. Should NASCAR come up with a different cup format to ensure an exciting end of season?
No, because NASCAR is not the NFL. They don't jury-rig their schedule to get better TV. They thought they had a gold mine with this sprint for the cup. It is still, I think, a great idea. The problem is Jimmy Johnson's just too good for the track right now.
Okay, baseball quiz question. If you win 16 games pitching for the Kansas City Royals and you win the Cy Young Award, as Zach Greinke did, how long before you become a New York Yankee?
Don't say that. The people in Kansas City are going to cry. Okay, just don't say that. you don't know. This guy is one of these guys who talks about how much he likes the slow-paced, low-key atmosphere in Kansas City. But, you know, you can be low-key and slow-paced in New York, too. It's just harder to get a cab.
This week, Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig came out in favor of, quote, tightening the playoff schedule next season, and he opposed the expanded use of video replay. Do you agree with either or both of those positions?
The replay thing I'm a very big believer in. I think that the human element of screw-up should be taken out of the game. I mean, I can't imagine anyone who thinks that the lengthy playoffs are a good idea. So, yeah, I guess I'm on Bud's side on one of them and against him on another.
Tiger Woods is currently building a new house on four adjacent properties in Florida, which he bought for $44 million. And apparently the neighbors are not pleased because they say it looks like a Motel 6. What's wrong with that?
If you've ever seen Graceland, Elvis's mansion in Memphis, from the road, it looks like a Motel 6.
Maybe that's what he's imitating.
It could be he's built, maybe he'll have, you know, a piano room and a gold room and a jungle room and stuff. I have no idea. By the way, are we really, really going to discuss Florida's zoning disputes on this show?
Sports!
Charlie,
this week, middle distance runner Rashid Ramzi of Bahrain was stripped of the gold medal that he had won in Beijing because a test of his blood drawn at the Olympics last summer came up positive for a banned substance. The test was not available at the Beijing Games. The testers now hold on to the blood samples for 8 years in case new tests are developed. I'm wondering, should Olympic medals just not be awarded until 8 years after the competition?
That's the ineffable logic of the drug tester's position in this thing. Besides, if I'm this runner, I'm not giving it back. It's staying in my den. What's the IOC
going
to show up with a SWAT team in Bahrain? Yeah, you can take my name off the list, but I'm not giving the hardware back, folks. In the immortal words of Thierry Henry, hey, it was your job to catch me then.
South African runner Caster Semenya will keep the gold medal and prize money that she won at the most recent World Championships in Berlin. The International Association of Athletics Federations announced this week that, quote, whatever scientific tests were conducted, end quote, on Semenya will remain a confidential matter between patient and doctor. Do we believe this, or was somebody at the IAAF winking?
First of all, I'm sure that this decision is basically to get them out of a very messy situation the easiest way possible. The second of all, I will believe this IAAF promise when she runs again and we don't hear about these tests.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not leaked by someone.
Charlie, it's hard to believe that the Pistons Pacers so-called Malice at the Palace brawl happened 5 years ago this past Thursday, but it did. Apparently, Ron Artest called the fan who helped incite that melee by throwing a beverage at him to suggest that together they should do something for the community. Any recommendations for what Ron and the fan ought to try and do?
I don't know what they ought to do, but I think a beer summit is probably out.
This week, Brendan Shanahan, late of the New Jersey Devils, said, I would like to thank my family and all my friends who have helped me achieve my childhood dream of playing in the National Hockey League. Mr. Shanahan's a lucky guy. His dream lasted almost 22 years.
He had one of those NHL careers, those inexplicable NHL careers in a violent and very vigorous sport where these guys play for almost 25 years. He was a terrific player, a real staple on the Detroit teams, some of the vintage Detroit teams, and he will be missed.
And finally, Charlie, folks who sing national anthems before sporting events run lots of risks. They can forget the words, of course. We've all witnessed that. They can sing off key. But last week, before a rugby match in Cape Town between a South African team and a French team, a reggae singer butchered the South African anthem so badly that members of parliament have accused him of treason. How often does this happen?
I'll tell you one thing. There's a memorable YouTube clip, and if that applied in this country, Carl Lewis would not be out of Leavenworth yet. And there's nothing to say what would have happened to Roseanne Barr.
I thank you for bringing up those memorable renditions of the national anthem.
Hey, it was their job back then to stop them. It wasn't my job.
Shirley Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Stay out of Dublin, Monsieur Henri.
Much to the delight of Major League Soccer's front office, the team employing David Beckham and Landon Donovan will compete for the MLS Championship tomorrow. The LA Galaxy will face Real Salt Lake in the championship game at Quest Field in Seattle. Our games are supposed to serve as a diversion, but often particular teams take on significance beyond that function. Many Cubs fans regard themselves as special for the suffering they've endured. During the Spanish Civil War, Catalan fans of FC Barcelona saw cheering for their team as a way to oppose the fascism of the Franco regime. And according to Robert Edelman, whose new book, Spartak Moscow, chronicles the history of Russia's most enduring soccer team, cheering for Spartak provided that team's supporters with, quote, a small way of saying no. Robert Edelman joins me now from the University of California at San Diego. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks so much, Bill.
Let's start with Spartak's beginnings. It would be no exaggeration, I guess, to say the team started as a family affair.
Well, they essentially begin as a bunch of friends in a very tough working-class neighborhood in Moscow. Their roots go back to before the revolution, and the four Starostin brothers were kind of the ringleaders of all their buddies, and they played street football like kids did all over the world.
Was Spartak immediately identifiable as the team Russians rooted for if they opposed the police and the army? Because that's the way you characterize them.
Well, it was a process. In the 1920s, they form a team in their neighborhood. Their biggest rival in 1923 is Dinamo. Dinamo is the team founded by the secret police. But this rivalry doesn't really begin until soccer becomes professional in 1936. Now, the other thing, of course, that's going on in 1936, 37, and 38 are the show trials, the Great Terror. People hate the police. And so supporting a civilian team is a way of distancing oneself safely from the authority. So they're not talking about actual opposition or regime change or anything like that. They're just trying to find a way, fans are, to hold on to their dignity, if you want to call it that, their independence, which, of course, is a tricky thing to manage in a Soviet state.
In 1939, Spartak was involved in a political situation unlike any I've ever encountered in the annals of soccer. Politics
Indeed.
Led to this unusual circumstance, a tournament in which a semifinal match was contested after the final had already been played. How did that happen?
Bill, you're giving away the punchline here.
You need All to tell right. us the story anyway.
I'm going to tell you this story, of course. In November 1938, Lavrenti Beria from the Republic of Georgia assumes the head of the secret police. He does this because he's replacing Nikolai Yezhov, who was a complete madman and was directly responsible for the execution of roughly 700,000 people in this two-year period. They actually bring Beria in to kind of calm things down. So that's good for the country. But it's not good for Spartak because Beria is head of the secret police, honorary chairman of the Dinamo Sports Society, a former player, and the Soviet equivalent of a meddling owner. Let's put it that way. If you try to put George Steinbrenner, J. Edgar Hoover, and Adolf Eichmann into one person, you'd have Lavrenti. On September 8th, Spartak beats Dinamo Tbilisi in Moscow in the semifinal again by a score of 1-0. On a disputed goal. Dinamo Tbilisi protests. The state sports committee denies the protest. 4 days later, the final is played. Spartak wins. They parade the cup around the stadium. They all go back home and resume the regular season. And then after a couple of weeks, it's then announced by the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union that the match is going to be replayed. And so now this was important. This is a big deal to the fans, you can imagine, because the total integrity of the game at this point would have been completely shot. So the replay does take place on September 30th. Spartak wins 3-2. And I've seen footage of Beria leaving the stadium in a huff after this, and Staristan then told one of his players many years later, "I knew at that time I was going on a long trip."
And the long trip obviously led to his incarceration.
That's correct. Soon thereafter, Beria tried to have him arrested. This is in 39. Him and the brothers and several of their colleagues. Molotov, who was then prime minister, refuses to sign the arrest order. In 1942, with the war on, the brothers are brought into the Lubyanka, you know, the big, horrible prison in the middle of Moscow. They are, quote, tried, end quote, and eventually, after a couple of years of being held in Moscow, sent to their various places of Siberian exile. When they arrive at these camps, the first thing that's important to know is that the camp commandants are so thrilled. These guys are the biggest celebrities in Soviet soccer, right? And there's actually a bureaucratic competition to see who gets them at their camp. As a result of this, they don't have to do hard labor. They don't have to live in the hard barracks. They stay in their team's locker rooms, and their lives are saved.
Nikolai Staristan, long the man who ran Spartak, in fact had his soccer expertise to thank for his eventual release from prison in 1948. How did soccer rescue him, at least temporarily?
Well, exactly, temporarily. In 1945-46, shortly after the war, Joseph Stalin's wastrel, permanently drunk, or at least often drunk, son, Vasily, decided to become the new sort of czar, if you'd pardon the expression, of Soviet sport. He had a high position. He was a general in the Air Force, and he created an Air Force sports club that then proceeded to try to recruit players in a whole variety of sports, men's sports, women's sports, motorcycle racing. One day, according to his memoirs, Nikolai Staristan is summoned to the telephone at his camp, and it says Stalin's on the phone. Turns out, of course, it's not Joseph, but Vasily, who invites him to come to Moscow and coach the Air Force team. And this does not please Beria. So we then have this kind of bureaucratic tussle between Beria and Stalin's son, in which poor old Nikolai is the pawn. Now, the good thing about this is that Nikolai gets to see his family. Then, when Beria gets wind of it, he puts him on a train back to Siberia. At this point, Vasily Stalin intercepts the train and brings Staristan back to Moscow, but says, "No, no, no. You cannot go to your home. You have to stay with me in my mansion." And according to legend, right, at least Staristan's legend, they slept in the same bed, with Vasily having a pistol under his pillow and obviously in a state of, you know, continuous inebriation. And many years later, there was a biography written about Vasily, and they quote his wife saying, "Staristan? In my husband's bed? Where was I?"
You write that match fixing has not been unknown in Russian soccer, but one particular story of an arranged game stuck out for me. It occurred in 1969, and what makes the tale unusual is what Spartak allegedly agreed to trade for a win. Tell us about this unlikely connection between soccer and the housing market in Moscow.
One of the hardest things is to get an ex-player, coach, whatever, to talk about a fixed match, right? So I was interviewing Gennady Lagafiet, who was a star for many, many years, a defender, midfielder. I said, "Did you ever take part in a rigged match?" And he said, "Only once." Well, we needed a win at the end of the season. We were playing the Central Army team. Dynamo Kiev was nipping at our heels. And the Army team was going nowhere. They were solidly set in fourth place. the Army team would agree to lose in return for 4 apartments. So it actually, Starostin, through his various contacts in the Moscow City Council, had better access to Moscow apartments than the Army did.
Robert Edelman is the author of Spartak Moscow, a history of the people's team in the workers' state, published by Cornell University Press. He joined me from the University of California at San Diego. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for speaking with me.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trevoux. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jeremy Bernfeld. We had help this week from Michael Garth and from Russell Wells at Georgia Public Broadcasting and from Andy Harper at the University of Mississippi. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Karen Given's Rock the Ages photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from Gene Long, who reveals the real impetus for the development of the fiberglass goalie mask.
Originally, it was just to, to stop that image of every Canadian hockey player having no teeth.
Nice work there. Now on to the forwards and defensemen who comprise the other 92% of hockey rosters. This message brought to you by the Canadian Dental Association, or CDE for short. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.